Reset your system clock to 1992 and join us on today's multimedia hyperguide tour of Windows 3.1. Again, folks, I'm your host SuperVGA, and in today's episode I'm going to talk about the Windows 3.1 shareware classic, The Adventures of Microman. It's good to be with you all again, you all being the shockingly I think 16 people that signed up since I put this podcast live 1 week ago. That was kind of a shock. I was hoping for my audience of 1 to 2 people, and I was going to be completely satisfied with that. But 16 of you has meant that's to me an overwhelming recommendation that this show ain't so bad. So it's good to be back. I've spent the week kind of putting together some show notes for this episode. I found it very exciting just to do the research. Part of what makes this job really fun is I get to play some games and write about them, which is really exciting for me. A big, big surprise was an email from the first email from Anar, who writes to us from Azerbaijan. Holy cow. I don't know about you, but getting an email from the other side of the planet is still an amazing thing to me. I can remember, seeing some of my first internationally sent email messages, and as well as bulletin board system messages back in the 1990s really blew my mind. Getting an email from Australia was still a big deal. And I think, that's become commonplace to us over the years, and I don't think it has to be. I think it's wonderful. So thank you, Anar. Anar writes, just a quick note to say thank you for making this and keep up the good work. I was a bit late for the Windows 3.1 thing, being 8 years old in 94 and living in Azerbaijan, where at the time a computer was something running a Norton Commander at best and only accessible for offices and big companies. But your podcast threw me back to 1999. Buying my own first machine and getting excited about a free CD-ROM with lots of shareware DOS games and an inkjet printer. Have a great one, Anar. And I wrote back to Anar and expressed my appreciation, and he also followed it up with this message. I asked him what his first machine was that he got in 1999, and he writes, my first beast of a machine was an AMD K62 with 64 megs of SD RAM and 8.4 gig hard drive. My parents did not want me to play games on the PC, bad for school, I guess, so I ended up with a crappy 2 meg SIS video card that could still run Doom in Settlers 2, haha. The main purpose for this computer was me making music, so I spent a lot of time with Cakewalk 6 and Cool Edit Pro when I was a kid. Another cool thing about that was that I had a PSR synthesizer plugged into the MIDI port all the time, so imagine my shock when I first ran Doom and suddenly the music started playing from the speakers of my keyboard. I was quite lucky, you may say. Fast forward 19 years ahead, and I am a music producer with more computers and synths in my house than I have chairs. But sitting proudly on the table amongst all the fancy tech is the same CRT monitor I've had since back in the day. Somehow, I can't let go of the feeling that the old computing era was much more exciting, and that old Samsung, I'm assuming CRT, is the window into those happy old days. So thank you again for this podcast, and I'm looking for the next episode. Well, Anar, the next episode is here. That's a wonderful story. I think all of us, or most of us, can have some very intense experiences with our first computer, either the first computer that our parents bought for us as kids, or if we were a bit later on, our first computer that we bought for ourselves. And that was no different for me. When I went through many, many computers over the years, I still get a great feeling when I get a new machine. So please keep sending in emails. I love, 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 love hearing your experiences. One thing that always surprises me is that even though people are, you know, a continent or three away from us, we still tend to have very, very similar experiences. You know, I grew up in the cold Canadian North, and it surprises me that someone, you know, halfway across the planet still knows the excitement of getting a new machine and also the disappointment of having a crappy 2 meg SIS video card that probably had absolutely no 3D acceleration. Yeah, please write in. I'll love to read your letters on the air. And now for a little segment I call Inventory Check. This is basically my excuse to do a little show and tell over the radio. So for 2 days, I call it Inventory Check. I have a copy of CorelDRAW 4 that came in the mail. I'm going to slide this open a little bit so I can share with you what I've got. This is CorelDRAW 4 English Upgrade Edition, made in Canada. I believe, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, that Corel Corporation was a Canadian outfit. This is a huge box. I'm guessing it's, I don't know if you can hear this thing wobbling around. It is the size of, let's say, three average IBM PC games stacked together. It slides out kind of like a, I don't know, one of those IKEA magazine holders. And inside, I've got an installation guide, an ad for Corel Art Show 3, which looks like to me it was a collection of clip art, potentially, a quick reference booklet, two CD-ROMs, one of which is the actual installation disk for CorelDRAW 4, and the other one just is disk 2. It says, and more. I'm guessing the disk 2 probably... Disk 2 probably contains a lot of the clip art that CorelDRAW was famous for. Now, here's the kicker. It has a gigantic manual, which I've been very excited about reading. I have a very long history with CorelDRAW that started... actually, a long family history with CorelDRAW that started when my uncle bought his first copy of CorelDRAW back in 1992, I want to say, possibly 91. I've got some very fond memories of this program. So in a future episode, I want to tell you a little bit about the story of how I came across CorelDRAW. Suffice to say, I was a little disappointed ordering this from eBay. The picture that the seller showed, I'm assuming that's the right word, the picture that the seller put on the ad was of a sealed CorelDRAW 4 box, which was very exciting, and it was for a very reasonable price. I think I paid $10 US for it, which is kind of unbelievable. And after some haggling over email, because the seller wanted me to pay more shipping to Canada, which is fine. I paid, I think, 30 or 40 US dollars to get it shipped here. The box arrived not only in opened condition, but missing stuff. I don't know if this was a classic bait and switch that apparently happens on eBay every once in a while, or if the seller made a serious mistake with the photo they put up and they put up some generic photo they found on the net. But it is missing the CorelDRAW for clip art book, where you could actually flip through the images of all of the clip art in that came on the CD. So that was a disappointment. I'm okay with open box stuff. In fact, I don't really collect or keep shrink wrapped stuff. I tend to be the type that opens it up. I can imagine a few of you are cringing at this. I will occasionally, very occasionally, keep something in its shrink wrap, but usually that's, I'm putting away the box, by the way. Usually that's because I intend to trade it away or sell it to somebody else at some point. I tend to be the kind of guy who opens things up and plays with them. So if you are a shrink wrap collector, you may send in your hate mail, and I will be very happy to read it over the airwaves. So in a future episode, I'll be very happy to talk about the CorelDRAW series of vector art programs, and we will talk about it then. So today's topic, jumping right in, is the shareware classic, and I should say cult classic, The Adventures of Microman. And I've got a bit of a story about how I came across this game for the first time in my life. Every Saturday, my mom would drive us from the farm to the city to buy groceries. We lived about 45 minutes away, sometimes an hour, depending on traffic. On these rides back into the city, I'd usually stare out the window at the passing farms, or more often than not, grab my Game Boy and play Super Mario Land or Tetris to kill time. I think I also had a copy of Bubble Bobble 2, which my sister and I loved. I love trips to the city. The closest grocery store to our farm was on the outskirts of the city in a really seedy mall. Seedy as in dangerous, gun-toting, knife-wielding, bandits wandering the mall, shaking down people for money. Kind of on the wrong side of the tracks in our city. It was the kind of place where you'd hear about a shooting on the news a week later after you were visiting there, or, you know, it wasn't that bad all the time, but more often than not, you'd see profanity graffitied on the side of the building. Actually, that reminds me, my dad was so convinced that my sister and I would get robbed in the mall, he insisted that I didn't put my wallet in my back pocket of my jeans, you know, where the cool kids keep it, and I had to put my wallet in the front of my jeans, you know, in the front pocket, which is not made to really fit a wallet, where no one else kept it, and I can assure you I definitely did not look cool with a bulging wallet filling the front of my jeans when I visited the mall in the city. I think I remember, actually, I would kind of put it in the front of my jeans when I got out of our van, and then as soon as I got out of visual distance of my dad, I'd switch it to the back pocket. He was very paranoid about how dangerous our city was. So back to our story. In the year leading up to the purchase of our 486, so this is about a year before the last story I told you about how we acquired the IBM PS1, I had begun buying what was a relatively expensive magazine. It was $7.95 an issue, which in today's dollars, adjusted for inflation, is about $14. For a 13-year-old kid who is, you know, their only source of income, my only source of income was a few bucks I got from my parents for doing chores during the week and occasionally mowing lawns for other people. It was a lot of money. I looked at my magazine collection. The average issue of Cracked magazine, if you're familiar with the kind of Mad magazine ripoff, was about $2 at the time. So I was approximately spending four times as much on a magazine. The magazine was so expensive because, and this is critical, it came with a CD-ROM packed in a cardboard sleeve in every issue. Now here's the kicker. I did not even have a CD-ROM drive in our 286 computer when I was buying this magazine. So I'm hoping there's a few of you nodding your heads who remember what it was like to buy computer software that you couldn't actually use because your computer did not support it. The magazine itself was called CD-ROM Today, and CD-ROM Today came out irregularly at first. Sometimes they would have quarterly issues like the spring, summer, and fall issues of the magazine. And that was the first year the magazine was out. It came out less frequently. And this was kind of to my advantage because the big lag between issues gave me enough time to save up my allowance money to actually buy it. If it had been coming out monthly, $8 when I was a kid, yeah, I could have afforded it, but that also meant I was probably not going to be buying any other games that month. So it was a bit of a trade-off. I only knew of two CD-ROM drives that I had access to at the time. One was at my school, and that was in a Mac Performa. Actually, sorry, I should say Macintosh Performa that sat in our school's library. The Performa had a CD-ROM drive that was actually a Caddy. We're used to the tray CD-ROM drives, but if anybody remembers Caddies, they were this square plastic enclosure that basically looked like a jewel case. It's made to hold a CD, except that in the bottom there was a slot to allow the laser in the CD-ROM drive to read data from it. Our librarian, Rose, wouldn't allow us to touch the CDs themselves. They were always kept in the caddy, and the only thing we were really allowed to do was to push the caddy into the CD-ROM drive. And she would kind of watch us over our shoulders to make sure we didn't damage her precious machine. she told us that these discs were worth hundreds of dollars. I believe that. Some of the discs reference discs for librarians were quite expensive. So basically no kid fingers allowed. One day I brought in my copies of CD-ROM today and I asked Rose if I could put the CD-ROM into the Macintosh. And she stepped back and she said, "Oh no. Oh no, you might mess up the computer." So I didn't push it. I realized that that was out as an option. The other CD-ROM drive that I knew of was actually at the mall. It was a compact Presario. It looked a lot like the all-in-one Performas. It also had an integrated CD-ROM drive and a floppy drive, but it was an IBM PC compatible. The store that sold it, CompuCenter, put it out on display near the edge of the mall, near the edge of the store entrance in the mall, kind of just inside the door so they could slide those accordion doors over it at night. One day, I decided I was going to play my CD-ROM Today disc on the compact Presario at CompuCenter. So I put on my best kangaroo jacket, and kangaroo jackets, they're kind of like a hoodie without the hood at the back. They've got that kangaroo pocket in the front where you can stick both hands in. I stuffed that with a few of my CD-ROM Today CDs, and my plan was I was going to walk up to the store and kind of quietly slip it into the CD-ROM tray and play it as if no one would notice that. So this time I walked up to the machine, and on it was playing a demo of Flashback, The Quest for Identity. And I think I was just so stunned watching this demo. The animation was so smooth, I forgot about my little plan. Eventually it kind of clicked in, oh yeah, that's why I'm here. I want to test out my game. So I quietly exited Flashback after experimenting with some keystrokes to figure out how to exit the demo, because it was on kind of demo autoplay mode. And when it dropped to the DOS prompt, I kind of chickened out. I saw that there was an employee kind of looking at me because he saw me typing stuff into the keyboard, and then he started to walk over and I panicked. So I did a quick dir/p on the directory, found, I think it was fb.exe, ran that, and the game loaded up again. So by the time he got back, it was playing the demo again. And he said, "Can I help you with something? Do you know? And I panicked and I said, no, I'm okay. I was just checking out the game. I'm going now." And I never got to try my CD-ROM Today. So I hung on to those issues of CD-ROM Today and the discs that they came with for over a year without getting to try them. And I can't tell you how much it hurt to know that there were literally gigabytes of data. I think I had 3 or 4 issues by the end of the year. Gigs of data waiting to be explored that I couldn't do a thing about. The magazine, and this made it even more painful, towards the back section of the magazine, it would actually review some of the game demos that were contained on the CD in each issue, and I daydream about each of these games in my bedroom. So finally, the big day came when we got our 486, and that's the story I told you in episode 1. I spent an entire month, at least maybe 6-8 weeks, exploring every nook and cranny of those CD-ROM Today discs. There were hundreds of games and applications. I don't exaggerate that. It was a lot. I think I had 6 or 7 discs by that point. And each one, and again, this will be a separate episode on CD-ROM Today, I think. I can't cover it all here. They had cheesy digitized videos of staff introducing each magazine issue. I loved it. I loved digitized video. I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever saw. Finally, On the 8th issue of the disc, that's what it was called, the disc, I found a shareware game that should have never stood out to me. The graphics were basically nothing to write home about. The animation was nowhere near the bar set by a game like King's Quest V. But it still appealed to me. That game was our topic of today, called Micro Man. It was low on my priority list when I first saw the shareware, A, because it was a shareware game, and shareware games were usually fairly short and of, honestly, let's say, inferior quality compared to the multi-million dollar productions that were going on at Sierra, LucasArts, and Origin. I think I must have ran out of games I wanted to play at this point, because I kind of said, okay, well, now that I'm done with all of the great game demos from really big companies, I'm willing to try some shareware. What caught my attention with Micro Man was that it actually ran under Windows 3.1. That was something fairly special at the time, because all of the shareware games up to that point I had seen were DOS only, and those were shareware game companies like Apogee, Apogee being famous for, I would say, kind of its side-scrollers more than anything else. Games for Windows 3.1 or Windows 3.0 were very rare. You know, aside from Minesweeper and Solitaire or Reverse-E, if you remember Reverse-E from Windows 2, were the only games that I really knew of for the Windows 3.1 operating system. So I gave it a shot. I can't say that I was blown away by the adventures of Micro Man at the time, but it was compelling. I mean, I had played Super Mario Bros. 3 for years by this point, which by any definition had better music, better controls, way faster scrolling. I think Mario 3 ran at around 60 frames a second. And yet, strangely enough, Micro Man had me. It kind of felt like a cross of, and I'm going to rattle off some Nintendo titles here, A Boy in His Blob, Mega Man, and Metroid. Oh, there's my cat saying hi. I think he's ran out of attention. He needs to be refilled with attention like gasoline in a car. What I liked about Micro Man was that it wasn't so absolutely punishing like a game like Mega Man was. In fact, I was able to finish the shareware, which, you know, I was willing to put some time into games at that point, but I wasn't really famous for finishing games. So I liked it. It wasn't enough to push me to send in money to the author for the full version, but there was something unique enough to get me going back to it. Every few months, I'd say, yeah, I kind of want to try Micro Man again. So in today's episode, I'd like to talk about the adventures of Micro Man and just what makes it a fascinating piece of Windows 3.1 history. And I might add, a bit of a cult classic, because there are several fan sites out there that celebrate Micro Man. Today's episode, we'll talk about its creator, its development, and the bit of a following it's created in the 25 years since it came out. In my show notes here, it says, let's talk genre, stealing a line from one of my favorite podcasts, Joe Mastriani's UMB cast. I'm going to skip over genre and just tell you Micro Man's a platformer. In fact, I don't think I'm going to talk much about genre in any of these episodes, because I'm going to assume that our listenership, if that's a thing, all 16 of you out there, generally know what a platformer is. It's jumping from platform A to platform B to make it further on the game. It involves a lot of jumping and avoiding enemies. So you'll probably know of typical platformers like the Super Mario Brothers series. For me, near and dear to my heart, Crystal Caves, the Apogee Shareware Classic, and Commander Keen, not to name a few. So the only difference between Micro Man and something like Mario is Micro Man is able to shoot a little laser blaster. So let's just say that interaction is organized around running, jumping, and shooting stuff. There is a bit of an attempt at a story. At least you get the story actually by hitting the About Story button under the Help menu, which is quite amazing. It's not integrated into the actual game. The story goes, and the author writes, Microman is the victim of a top-secret experiment that went terribly wrong. Wearing a special weapon suit, Bob Jones voluntarily stepped into the molecular miniaturizer created by Dr. Schnapps. I assume Dr. Schnapps is some sort of reference to Schnapps the drink, the alcohol. Dr. Schnapps turned on the power and the miniaturization process began. After a few minutes of blinding light, Bob Jones was reduced to the size of a few microns. The experiment seemed to be a success, but the molecular miniaturizer suddenly started smoking and a few seconds later exploded, killing all of those in the lab, including Dr. Schnapps. Bob Jones, now known as Microman, was never found after the explosion. However, since the molecular miniaturizer, and its creator had both been destroyed, it didn't really matter because there was no hope to return him to his original size. Microman now finds himself in a strange and hostile world where he is one of the smallest inhabitants. Now his mission is personal, to explore and to stay alive. We'll talk really briefly about Microman's gameplay. Microman basically always takes damage from collision with enemies or the shots fired by enemies. So jumping in on an enemy's head like we'd see in the Mario series, you can't use that as a gameplay tactic. You just generally try to avoid enemies by either killing them at a distance or jumping over them. And like I said, you've got this little pea shooter kind of... I said laser earlier, but I think more accurately, we'd say it's a pea shooter. It shoots these little round spherical bubbles, and it shoots them in a straight line. Basically, in the game, if something looks remotely like an animal or a robot and it's animated and moving, it's gonna kill you. So Microman, sharing, again, its relationship with earlier platformers, has an energy bar. And when his energy is depleted due to damage from enemies, it's game over. There are no extra lives. Like Metroid, and I think maybe this is what made Microman stand out for some people, Microman gets upgrades. He can fly higher with a super jump boost or, for instance, get guided missiles as an upgrade to the standard shot. You can even get a larger energy bar. And in order to progress in the game, you really do need to... focus on getting upgrades. I noticed that the room layouts are surprisingly intuitive. Maybe this is one of the reasons why the game appealed to me so much. The rooms are clearly handcrafted. There's no random generation happening here. The author spent a lot of time tweaking each level to make it a combination of challenging and enjoyable. The first few rooms, I would say, are actually designed as a tutorial should be. That is, they show the player how to progress without beating them over the head with instructions. I really appreciate that because I think in the last 10 years, I don't want to philosophize or wax poetically about design, but I've noticed that in the last 10, 15 years, games have moved away from just throwing you into a gameplay situation into... we're going to spend the first 45 minutes of the game teaching you how to play this. A game like Fallout 3 comes to mind, which tends to, beat you over the head with instructions. As an older gamer, I appreciate just being thrown in, maybe being given a command reference card and saying, good luck, kid. Let me know how that works out for you. I appreciate that. So in this case, what I notice is there's not a lot of hand-holding, but they do show you how to progress in the game by saying, hey, look, you can jump, you can shoot, you can run back and forth. Try using those in some combination to make it from platform A to platform B and then exit the screen. One thing I should say about this is that this is not a side-scroller as we've come to understand them. This is less like Super Mario 3 and more like The Legend of Zelda. So the screen does not scroll smoothly side to side when you move. In fact, the room is entirely static until you hit the edge of the screen and it then will load the neighboring screen. So again, Legend of Zelda is what comes to mind. And there is a technical reason for this, which I hope we can talk about in the development portion of the show. One thing I noticed is Micro Man tends to float a bit in the air when he jumps. It's not a tight, heavy jump like we see in the Mega Man series. I'm sorry I'm making all these Nintendo references, but they're helpful because Nintendo spent a lot of its effort, developing side-scrollers, so that you can see a lot of different styles of side-scrollers in the Nintendo Entertainment System. He tends to float, I would say, more like the miner guy in Crystal Caves. It's almost like his body's made out of styrofoam. This makes jumping slightly easier because it gives you a little bit more thinking time as he goes through his little jumping arc. But it's also more difficult because the controls are a lot less responsive. I would say that if Mega Man is kind of like driving a Ferrari on the Autobahn, Micro Man is more like paddling a birch bark canoe in the Amazon. it's steering a boat. The objective of the game, interestingly, is simply to... Oh, my cat is back for his next dose of attention. The objective of the game, interestingly to me, is simply to explore the environment. It's not to overcome an evil villain or even return Micro Man to his former size. Your job is to explore and see how far you can get. I thought that was really refreshing. In a time where, you know, the attitude is every game needs to have a strong story. Every game needs to have a villain to overcome. We've kind of swallowed a lot of Kool-Aid over the years on design. This is refreshingly different. Above all else, I would say one thing stands out. And that is, again, the lack of the scrolling background. Micro Man was not alone in this. In fact, other games made this actually a very core feature of the game. I'm thinking, actually, of Flashback, The Quest for Identity, which has you running on a static screen, and one of the most beautiful games I've ever played in my life, Another World, or Out of This World for North Americans. Both of those I probably are going to give their own episodes to. I don't think Flashback ever came out for Windows, but I know that Another World did. I might even sneak in Flashback as some sort of, DOS prompt episode. So we'll talk about that non-scrolling background in a little bit. Let's talk style. Stylistically, Micro Man is surprisingly unique. Very few games, I've noticed, are organized around computers as the source material for world building. Backgrounds in this game are drawn as circuit boards and enemies as animal-like kind of reimaginings of circuit board components. So, for instance, there's a leech-looking thing that looks like a BIOS chip. Plenty of large robot-like creatures on wheels and tracks. My immediate thought is of a kind of lo-fi Tron, maybe, substituting green-printed circuit boards for neon lights. While the artwork certainly won't win any awards for its realism, it nonetheless is pretty charming. There's something playful and, to me, nonsensical about the level design and its enemies. I thought that the light-hearted kind of tone of the story was mostly expressed in the art, and much of it, just my opinion, was probably drawn in Microsoft Paint. The suggestion is, from the style of the art, that you're not supposed to take this altogether too seriously. The author himself, when writing about and reflecting on his game years later, called it programmer art. Most people use that word derisively to say, oh, well, this is just a bunch of programmer art that I did. And I thought this actually lent a little bit of playfulness to the game. Finally, a little bit on music. One of the things I noticed, and this is only apparent in the later 1.5 release of the game, is that it all of a sudden has a very catchy MIDI soundtrack. That's something I want to mention in the development history, but the MIDI soundtrack really stands out as particularly really nice, early 90s, I would say maybe EDM, electronic dance music. I thought it really stood out. Now it's time for the development history or development story. Again, Joe, if you ever listen to this podcast, I owe you so much in terms of its structure. The creation of this game was the creation of a single guy. Brian Goebel, and I hope I am pronouncing your name properly, Brian. Brian Goebel hailed from the greater Seattle area of Washington in the United States, and he fell in love with computers, he said, in the seventh grade when he took a programming class on the school's Commodore PETS. After he had this experience playing with the PETS, he begged his dad for one, and unfortunately he couldn't get one. Don't know why. I'm assuming, like most kids who grew up in the 90s, it was probably a money-related thing. Instead, his dad managed to get him a loaner, Timex Sinclair, for a few weeks that summer. For anyone unfamiliar with the Timex Sinclair 1000, this is basically a Sinclair Research ZX81 rebuilt for NTSC televisions, and it had double the amount of RAM, I think, at 2K instead of 1K. There were several Timex Sinclair models out there, a few, in North America. It was kind of a joint venture between Sinclair Research and, this is odd, Timex Corporation. Yes, the watch manufacturer got involved in building computers for a while. So Brian spent the summer hammering away on the Sinclair and managed to program his own game. I'm assuming this was done in Sinclair Basic. I actually should have looked up the actual Basic in ROM that it uses, but I forgot to. He programmed his own game, which he says was only fun for about 2 minutes. And then in brackets, he says, okay, actually 1 minute. Now my cat has decided that coming on my lap is more important than anything else. So, you can stay here for as long as you like. Back to our story. That little game was enough to convince Brian's dad to buy him a family computer, an Atari 800. He started it off with a cassette tape drive, and this is something I'm very familiar with because I had a cassette tape drive on my first family computer, a Tandy Trash 80 or TRS-80. He started out with this cassette drive, and he had to save up to four cassettes at a time, save his programs to four cassettes at a time, just to make sure that one of those four backups would work properly when he tried to load it. And he said one day he got so mad that he slammed the tape drive with his fist and broke the reverse mechanism on it. And now, to make things even worse, every time he needed to rewind a cassette, he had to run upstairs to the family stereo system to use the stereo system's cassette player rewinder. So I can imagine how enjoyable that was. He eventually bought over 100 games on discs from a friend at school, even though he didn't even have a disc drive for his Atari 800. Trust me, you'll hear this many times in this podcast, that I tended to buy software before I had the hardware capable of running it. Hopefully some of you have some stories about that too. He eventually got an Atari 1050 tape drive, disk drive. Let me fix my notes. He did not have a second tape drive, he had a disk drive. So you can imagine how he spent the rest of his time once he got those games running. I'm sure he just disappeared. So after a couple of years with the Atari 800, it doesn't say how long, but I'm assuming 2 to 3 to 4 years, his family bought a 286. And this is where he said his more serious programming started, first with BASIC. And then after an encounter with, it sounds like a friend of the family potentially, who was an 8086 assembly programmer, Brian began writing his own games in assembler. In fact, he even made a bit of money doing contracts for the guy who taught him 8086 assembler. And I don't actually know who this is. That guy that taught him 8086 assembler went on to become someone who is a bigwig at Microsoft. So I thought that was quite fascinating. I'd love to know who that is. If you happen to know who taught Brian, or maybe someday I'll send an email to Brian and just ask, that would be wonderful. He eventually attended the University of Washington, where he worked as a research engineer in the Department of CS, Computing Sciences. And this is where he honed a bunch of his skills and eventually landing a publishing deal with SoftDisk. You'll remember SoftDisk as the software publisher who ran a monthly diskette service that you'd subscribe to. They'd send you a bunch of games and applications on a disk once a month, or you know, maybe not every month, but quarterly sometimes, for different operating systems. I think SoftDisk started off with the Apple II and then quickly expanded out to support other OSs. Brian's game, Galactic Battle, was a Space Invaders clone that I could see seemed to be a very direct copy of it, except for the fact that it added a shield button, so you could actually produce a little shield on it instead of hiding behind those, I don't know what to call them, bunkers? His game was published on the Big Blue Disc, number 39. So the Big Blue Disc was SoftDisk's IBM PC-compatible series of releases. Many of us should remember SoftDisk as the company that several id Software employees worked at before they mutinied and started their own company. That's a story best left told to a book called Masters of Doom. I won't cover that on this podcast. It's been so well covered elsewhere. So eventually, Brian began programming applications. Let's assume that they're probably games. For Windows, I'm guessing Windows 3.0 and eventually Windows 3.1. He went on to develop, and I would love to know the story of how this began kind of an organically from beginnings as a series of functions and utilities and eventually becoming an animation package on WAP, Windows Animation Package. And this is from the Microman README file. WAP stands for Windows Animation Package. The package implements real software sprites and Flickr-free sprite animation under Microsoft Windows. WAP was developed for use with 8-bit color, but is able to execute on systems using less than 256 colors as well. The heart of WAP is the WAP.obg, WAP.object file, which is linked with the Windows application that wants to use WAP services. WAP also consists of three utility applications for capturing sprites, editing rooms and maps, and manipulating palettes. WAP was developed by, you know, Brian L. Goebel. WAP stands out to me because it was one of the first 2D gaming engines that actually could do Flickr-free sprite animation in Windows. Now here's the funny thing. This is how Microman came to be. Previously, Brian had programmed his engine in DOS to release the animated DOS games. When he rewrote that engine for Windows, he wanted to see what was possible. So in order to demo WAP, he needed to have some sort of gameplay to show it off. He needed a demo game. So what he did was he stole some art from a DOS game that he'd been working on called Alien Planet. Alien Planet ran in 320 by 200 resolution. So when he moved the game's artwork over to Windows, the objects looked tiny when they were scaled down at 640 by 480. So instead of, you know, or at least let's say making lemons into lemonade, instead of doing a complete repaint, as I know many of you artist developers know how painful that is to repaint sprites from 320 by 200 to 640 by 480, he actually just ran them in their native 320 by 200 and just called the game Microman. Everything got shrinked down. I think that's an absolutely wonderful example of, ingenuity taking the place of what would have been a lot of hard work. I want to add a small piece of information that the MIDI music that really stood out in, let's say, the first shareware version of Microman was composed by a musical composer named Codicelli. There's a note here that, first of all, this was only added to version 1.5 of the game. So if you have version 1.0 of Microman, which is what came on that CD-ROM today, it was later updated to 1.5, you won't get MIDI music, but later versions do have it. Someone put a note here on Moby Games that kind of caught my attention, that the music was quite heavily influenced by the 1985 electro-hip-hop track Juice by the world-class Wrecking Crew. So there's a little bit of trivia for any of us listeners who are very interested in MIDI and mod music and its history in the EDM scene of the 80s and 90s. Now, because Micro Man was a shareware game, you'd get episode one just by downloading it. However, if you paid $25, you would receive a registered copy of the game, which gave you access to Adventure 2. And there was, and that is a slightly different style of game. Adventure 1 is called Crazy Computers, so that, you know, is obviously organized around the computing theme, themes of computing. Adventure 2, it changes its, let's say it's stylistically different, however, the gameplay mechanics are exactly the same. Adventure 2 is called Savage Stones. To be completely honest, because I didn't pay for the registered version of it, I never got to play Adventure 2. So that's going to be on my list for a later day. Today, I just want to really focus on the shareware version. Brian went on to hope to produce Adventure 3 called Wild Waters. That never happened. There are some promotional screenshots for it, but it definitely looks like it never came together. And there was even a suggestion of Adventure 4 Raging Rocks, which was supposed to be the fourth dose of Brian's drug, but that never happened. And the story of why that didn't happen, I suspect, is because, this may be a surprise to most, Brian became a founding member, founder of Monolith Productions. As founder, I think Brian assumed more of an engineering role with Monolith and was involved in projects like Shogo, MAD, Mobile Armor Division, Get Medieval, Blood 2, Grunts, to name a few. And, you know, of course, to many of us, and also I should mention No One Lives Forever, which is a favorite I know of a couple of our listeners. So it's fairly easy to imagine why Micro Man got put on the back shelf at some point, although Brian does go on to mention that the WAP engine received an upgrade for Windows 95 and extended it into the 32-bit universe. I thought that was fairly fascinating because it's not too common to see a game engine span both Windows 3.1 and Windows 95. And another cute little story about WAP I thought was fairly relevant to our story. Brian was working on a game called Nuclear Nightmare. And Nuclear Nightmare was going to become Apogee Software's first Windows 3.1 game. Eventually, Brian began to work on a remake of Micro Man with better art and higher sound quality. And that was actually to suit a deal between Microsoft and Apogee in 1994. The idea was Microsoft was looking for a game to ship with Windows 95 as its kind of flagship, I would call it its flagship game. Microsoft had one stipulation, however. The game had to clock in at just under 150 kilobytes. Windows 95 was going to ship on floppies, and there was no way that they could give Brian any more room than 150 KB, considering all of the other operating system stuff related to Windows 95 that had to ship. So Brian worked on it, and it didn't take long to realize that with the upgraded sound, the upgraded art that they had done for Micro Man, there was no way they could pack this all within the tight confinements that Microsoft requested for the project. So, unfortunately, that would have made some history for Brian. That never did happen, and probably history for Apogee too. Of course, Brian went on to make his own history, later leaving Monolith and founding Hipsoft, which became a web and mobile game developer and publisher. And in fact, even remade Micro Man at a much later date, so you can actually play Micro Man on any 32-bit operating system. And I will give you a link to Microman through Hipsoft. I can honestly tell you that there is something missing in the Hipsoft remake of Microman. Yes, the graphics are better. They're definitely an improvement. Yes, it's more playable on Windows, but there's something missing there. It seems like they went for a slightly more generic art style. The original programmer art that Brian did actually stands out to me as something very memorable. I just wanted to add a little note about WAP. In one of the files I found on textfiles.com, that's Jason Scott's archive of kind of anything pre-internet era, there's a little bit of a description about what WAP was. WAP was compiled using Microsoft C/C++ 7.0. He coded the entire thing in C, flat C, without using C++ style function calls. And he suggested that in future versions, he was going to be doing some hand optimization of the assembly language routines to get some more speed out of it. That seems very likely that he did it. He mentions that a WAP supports sprites, images, patterns, pages, rooms, and what he calls room sprites. There are a lot of different sprite features that he integrates into the engine. I won't go into a huge amount of detail into this, but given that this is the early 90s and Windows 3.1 is still very flaky in its animation support, I'm actually very impressed at the amount of flexibility his animation engine has. So I'm going to provide a link to the text file that describes this for anybody who wants to go into a bit deeper, dirtier detail in the kinds of functions and methods used in Brian's WAP engine. It's probably worth adding to non-coders that I would say the WAP engine methods tend to be a little bit more on the lower level side than something higher level like, let's say, Adventure Game Studio scripting. AGS script is a very straightforward, wonderful way of scripting something, get things moving on the screen very quickly. WAP tends to look to me more like straight up C. I'd love to know someday, hopefully if I can get a hold of Brian, just how WAP was used. Did anybody actually buy and license his engine? He was offering it. He doesn't suggest any prices, but he was offering it as something that could be licensed and used by other programmers. I'd love to know if there were actually any games made with it. So that's it for our little mini show on Microman. This ran about 20 minutes longer than I meant to. I guess my little story actually tended to be a bit longer than my discussion of Microman, unfortunately. I'll do my best to tighten that up if I can. If you have any suggestions for the show, like I said, topics or even structurally, how I can, you know, maybe make this fit into a more even 30 minutes or 40 minutes, I'd love to hear it. Any feedback you have is wonderful, positive or negative. I will not be offended whatsoever. So please write in. My email address is vga@vga256.com. And I hope to see you back next Sunday for another episode of Multimedia Hyperguide.